Were you supposed to be my host this weekend?
Well, sort of. Yeah. He's out in places like Cairo.
Just a minute. I hadn't heard from you since somebody called me and asked me to come down here. And then I called to get directions on coming down here, and I said, what's the name of that hotel that we're going to? He says, I don't know, just a minute. And I was on the road headed down here. So, and I said, well, I'll see you down. And he says, well, I guess. I'm Creighton Pendarvis. My name is You'll be all right. Don't drink and go to meetings and get a good sponsor. My name is Creighton Pendarvis, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the fellowship of the Program of Alcoholics Anonymous and some awfully good sponsorship, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, go to jail, or steal anything over $50 since the 1st of March of 1976. And I'm very grateful for that this morning. All right, before I ever make an AA talk, I do a couple of three things. And it'll be the most important thing I say this morning. And the first thing I do is I want to thank the committee for having me, and I will as soon as Sissy gives me the check. And I had there's conferences and conferences, and Bob and Laura and Roberta and I'm the rest of the speakers that were here and Ken last night go to a lot of conferences. And I got to tell you that we've been to big conferences, been to little conferences. The best friend I have in the world is sitting right here, Mark, Mock. Everybody knows Mock. And you can go to conferences of 2,000 and 3,000 people. You know, we have huge conferences now. Let me share something with you. The Flint River Conference is one of the best that you can have. 150, 200, 300 people. Because you get to know the people. You get to know the people. And any speaker that isolates themselves and you know, becomes a guru and goes off someplace, you don't want to have them back. But I got to know a lot of people here because I'm going to read something in a minute and you'll understand what I'm talking about. I got to know a lot of people here. And you helped me more than I'll ever, 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 ever help you. Because I see, you know, all the types of alcoholics that we are. And I'm one of those strange people. I'm like Ken. I'm a straight drunk. I never had anything up my nose more than a pencil eraser and a marble and my finger. I never had you know, any smack or any of that stuff, or never smoked any of them funny cigarettes. I'm just straight drunk. I'm, you know, about as unique as a Chevrolet when it comes to that. But the people I meet in AA today at these conferences, it's just wonderful. I just have a great time. And we've shucked and jived, and we've had a good time. And Ken and I rode around town. If you'd been a mouse in the corner, I love that. I'm going to use that. It almost looks a little risque, but that is so funny. But if you'd been a mouse in that car yesterday, you'd thought, and these guys are supposed to be spiritual gurus. You know? But we had the best time riding around this beautiful town of Bainbridge and sharing our strength and hope and laughing and carrying on and shedding a tear or two. And this has been one whale of a weekend, I got to tell you. I go to a lot of conferences, and this has been one of the top ones. And congratulations to you guys. Don't change a thing. Don't change a thing. It's wonderful. Okay, what I do before I start on anything is I read five observations of AA speakers. And these were given to me by my sponsor in Dallas, Texas, old David Aronofsky. He's gone to the big meeting in the sky. And David had me read these when I started speaking a long time ago, and I still read them at every opportunity that I have to speak. And this is what it says. It says five observations of AA speakers. Number one, AA speakers are just plain drunks. No different from you, believe me. Number two, they are not brighter or more sober or more successful or more spiritual. They're just more eager to hear the sound of their own voice. And number three, AA speakers are not special people. We come in all shapes, sizes, but periods of sobriety, levels of humility, just like you. And number four, use caution when you hear any AA speaker setting up a special meeting after the meeting for a closed-door inner circle of spirituality. Because we can guarantee that they're not carrying a message, but they may be spreading a disease. So be careful about those folks. And finally, beware of any AA speaker who uses an inordinate amount of profanity. It's immature, it's inappropriate, it's unimpressive, it's stupid, and it's certainly not part of any AA program we're familiar with. Well, the first time I read those, I sat down. I didn't have anything else to say about it. But second thing I'm going to read will be probably the most important thing I read this morning. And for the newcomers and the golden slippers in this crowd, this is what it's all about. Chapter 3, page 30, Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy our drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Remember what Ken said about delusion? This is the illusion that we could drink like other people. Here's the kicker. Here's the freedom. First line of the second paragraph. We learn that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. Well, on March the 1st of 1976, through a great deal of misunderstandings and a bit of tough luck, I shook two in a Lady Kenmore box under a bridge in North Kansas City, Missouri. And my drink of choice was Aqua Velva in those days. I had 40 cents in my pocket. I was dressed in my wardrobe. I had an old pair of marine green wool breeches on. Zippers rusted shut. I had a pair of yellow tennis shoes on for the same reason the zipper is rusted shut. And I had an old raggedy shirt and a leather flying jacket, and that was my wardrobe. That's all I had in this world. And I had 40 cents in my pocket. Listen to this. That morning dawned like a morning has in your life. I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. And that's the worst place for a drinking drunk to be. I was right in that limbo. And a lucid thought came to me, like Bob was talking about on Friday night, that I just wanted out. I didn't want to leave any notes, of remorse or anything that I was going to take my own life. I just wanted out. I wanted off the squirrel cage. I wanted out of all the dilemmas that I had caused for myself, and I knew where a car was parked. And this car belonged to some friends of mine, or had been friends of mine, and would be friends again. And I had 40 cents in my pocket, and I went down to the bus stop, and I hadn't had a bath in a long time. And I could have had any seat on that bus that I wanted. And I got on that bus, and guess what the bus fare was? 40 cents. That's exactly right. And all of a sudden, a great feeling of relief came over me because I had made a decision. I had made a decision that I was going to get out of this lifestyle. And I rode this bus out to where this car was, and I walked over to the house, and I broke into their garage. I found a vacuum cleaner hose, and I put one in the tailpipe and the other in the car, and I found the keys, and I put the keys in the ignition and got in and turned the ignition on, and nothing happened. And if you're bent on suicide, you've ruined your day right there. Here's what happened. Out of futility, and I love what Chuck Chamberlain used to say. He used to talk about this, and he says, it's surrender. And he'd just yell it out. And that's what I did that morning. Didn't know it at the time, but I surrendered. But out of futility that I couldn't kill myself, I yelled out something, God, if there is a God, please do something, because I can't even kill myself. I can't even kill myself. What am I going to do? And a thought was placed in my mind, have you tried AA? I knew all about AA, I thought. In 1950, I went to live with my dad in the summer of 1950. I was a puke 15-year-old pimply-faced kid that heard about my dad all my life. He had been a bad drunk. And he got sober in Charlotte, North Carolina on February the 10th of 1950. And that summer, he and I, his son, he hopped an old Vicuna coater. It was a beautiful Vicuna coat. And a Crosley radio, and we got in a 1948 Chevrolet, and we drove to Cleveland, Ohio. And we didn't have much money, but he and I had a heck of a time going up there talking. Because, you see, he was making amends to a kid that he had deserted many years before. And I love my dad. God, I love my dad. And we got up there, and we had one whale of a time at a thing called the First AA International Convention. I was an Alateen before there was Alateen. There was about 16 or 17 or 18 of us kids there. And a guy by the name of Clarence Snyder and his wife Betty, who were very, very controversial in AA. But they took us under their wing. And they took us out to where they lived and cooked hot dogs for us and introduced us to all the big shots at this conference, Dr. Bob and Sister Ignatia and Sam Shoemaker and Father Ed Dowling and, of course, Bill Wilson and Lois. And, you know, we weren't terribly impressed with all these people, but my dad was. And he says, you're getting to meet all these people. And he was very excited about it because he was so new. He had that newness of, that wonderful, wonderful aura of the newcomer who's finally grabbed on to this program. I'm not talking about the golden slipper, you know, it's got enough white chips to tile a bathroom floor. I'm talking about that one that really is thrown in the towel and they're ready to grab a hold of it. And they hung on to every word that was said, and we had the greatest time in the world. Now, his sponsor was named Hitler. And his sponsor's name was Footsie Gwynn out of Charlotte, North Carolina. And Footsie was there, too. And Footsie was just as kind as he could be. And he says, son, he says, one of these days, we're going to have a program for you kids. And later on, obviously, we do. It's called Alateen. And in those days, they called the gals. There weren't many women in AA at that time, for whatever reason. But there weren't a lot of women in AA, and the Al-Anons called themselves the Auxiliary. And the Auxiliary was wonderful. And when we got back to Charlotte, I used to go to Saturday night meetings with my dad and my stepmother. And after the meetings was one of the best meetings. Nothing's changed about that. The best meeting is not now. The best meeting is coming to this thing and going home from it, where all those in-depth inventories are taken. You know. We don't gossip in AA, but we share because we're very concerned about others. And did you see who he was with? Well, I don't think they're going to stay sober at all. She better keep her legs closed, and he better lay off. And he's not going to stay sober 15 minutes if he keeps on doing that. That's where the real meetings take place. Not right here. We're just a gathering spot for the meetings before and after the meetings. Well, nothing's changed in 52 years since that. Now, where are you going? Can't sit still for a minute. Just up and down and up and down. Well, that's what I thought I knew about AA in those days. And I didn't know a darn thing, you see, because I thought it was willpower that was keeping these folks sober. I thought that room full of several thousand people all had willpower to keep them sober. And I thought my dad had willpower. We got back to Charlotte. My dad became very active in 12-step calls. Very active in 12-step calls. We did a lot of 12-step calls, or they did a lot of 12-step calls in those days. This was before the spin-dry units and the jitter joints became into vogue. And there was one detox center in Charlotte, and it was our basement. And my dad was the new member, so he didn't have any choice. Footsie said, your basement's going to be where we detox. And there's a couple of guys, a couple of doctors in AA at that time. And since we had a basement, you know, it's hard for them to escape out of that basement because there's only one way out. And I was the kid that got to clean up after those drunks down in the basement. And guess what I said? I'm never going to drink. I'm never going to drink. Because I had seen the wreckage that it caused and all that. And I didn't realize what Bob was talking about Friday night and what we read in our big book and what Ken was talking about last night, that we suffer from a disease. And don't let anybody ever, 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 ever tell you any different. Whether they have a degree or several degrees behind their name. It's not a moral issue. It's a disease. Silky, God love him, Dr. Silkworth was so right. So right. And it's come to pass that many, many people, lots of research have gone on about our disease. And it's a disease of the mind and the body. It's as simple as that. And that's all we need to know, is that we suffer from a disease. A terribly morally debilitating disease, but it has nothing to do with willpower or moral issues. Okay. Well, I told you that I was in that car and I thought I knew all about AA and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And I broke into that house and I made a phone call and I looked at this phone number up in this book, in the phone book, and I was shaking like a peach orchard borer and my eyes were mucousy and I was filthy dirty, and I found this number and I called and the phone answered down at the North Kansas City group in North Kansas City, Missouri, and somebody was there. And it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and this is before the vogue of noon meetings. But imagine that, somebody was there. And he answered the phone, and of course, and the first thing I said is, do y'all have meetings? And he says, yeah. And I said, well, I've got this friend. And the next words were said, are you in trouble, son? Now, I never knew a drinking drunk that was in trouble. I said, nah, you know, a series of misunderstandings, a little tough luck, live under a bridge, dressed in a wardrobe, and don't have any money, but other than that, things are going pretty good for me, you know. And he said, well, come on down. He says, you have a car, and I didn't want him to think I was some Johnny-come-lately. And I said, well, sure. So 20 minutes later, I'm driving a stolen car to my first AA meeting. That had started this time. Imagine that. And on my way down there, true statement, on my way down there, I'm driving this stolen car and another thought comes to me. And I'm dressed in my wardrobe, don't have a suit on my name, I'm filthy dirty. And I think, I wonder if I'm bad enough to have to go to AA. You know? Denial is not the river in Egypt, as Jan was talking. I'm 27 years sober, and I'm still full of denial. I carry a comb, you know, just in case. Just in case, you know. Well, I walked into that hall, and it was at 1824 North Swift. And I knew exactly where it was because it was between night after night bar, time after time bar. On one side, there was a savings and loan next door, and then the slammer and the police department were on the other side. And I knew where the slammer was. I'd been a guest of North Kansas City Slammer on various occasions. But I didn't know that there was an AA hall upstairs above the savings and loan. Never had any money put in a savings and loan. But I walked up those steps, and I did this. I knocked on the door. And it's the only door of an AA hall I've ever knocked on. And somebody said, come in. I walked in, and there this guy stood. And he was a tall, lanky guy. And he had a great big smile on his face, and his hand was stuck out. Folks, don't ever, 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 ever remember that a smile and a handshake to the newcomer is worth more than $1 million. Because, like me, nobody had smiled at you for a long time. And I had to turn around to see who this guy was smiling at. And he says, "Hi, I'm Jack." And I stuck out a shaking, dirty, filthy, dirty hand. And I said, "I'm Creighton Pendarvis." And he said, "Would you run that name by just one more time? And the name is half Irish and half Greek." And I didn't know where to stay drunk or open a restaurant for a long time with a name like that. But I said, "Well, you can call me Captain," because I wanted him to realize immediately that, I, as he could probably tell, that I was an airline captain and just between trips. And he said, "Well, I'll call you Penn." And we sat down there and we talked about a lot of things. And I really don't remember exactly what we talked about. But I do remember this. Now, in a lot of groups and a lot of halls, AA halls, you have the steps on one side on a roller, and you got the traditions on the other side. And that club was no different. And I looked up there, and I was looking at the steps, and I turned to Jack, and I said, "Jack, I can't make it." And he said, without blinking an eye, he says, "Don't worry about that word God." And I thought, how the hell did he know? How did he know? But he knew. That evening, a meeting was going to be held, but I didn't know whether I was going to make it or not because I started shaking. And I mean, I really shook, just like you have. And Jack went down to his car and he said, first of all, he says, "You look like you need a drink." And I thought, ooh, what a deal this is. And Jack went down to his car like so many old timers and some of us still do. And he carried a jug in the back of his car for guys named Creighton. And he brought that jug up on sometime in the afternoon of March the 1st of 1976. I had my last drink in an AA hall. And I smoothed out. I smoothed out. Then I had that little nap. And the meeting started at 8 o'clock that night. How It Works was read. And I convulsed. Boom. Right on the floor. And I was laying there in a convulsion, and all the golden slippers were gathered around me, you know. It looked like a tree full of owls. They were looking down and said, "Ooh, we've heard about guys like this. Never seen a live one." But I was laying there flopping, and, well, I can say this. It's better to be a watcher than a flopper in a case like that. And Doc Newton was there that night and came up and gave me a pick-me-up. Some of the members picked me up and took me back to the back room, and they put a rubber sheet on the old couch so in case the captain wet his pants again, it wouldn't bleed through. And don't miss this. Don't miss this. The members of Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. Folks, just like the faces I'm looking at today, I don't know your names, but I know who you are, just like you know me. And you have that God-given talent that nobody else in this world has, and you can save lives. I don't care whether you have a third-grade education or more degrees than a rectal thermometer. You have the ability to save lives. Because you know me better than my mama does, and I know you better than your mama does. Because the disease of alcoholism is akin to each other. You got old wet washcloths and you put them on my forehead and you got the little tin pan and I vomited that old green vial. And I thought to myself, I thought, if you really knew the real Creighton Pendarvis, you'd get me the heck out of there. You'd kick me out in the street because I'm a facade. You don't know. I didn't know who I was, but I knew I was a liar, a cheat, a thief. And I didn't want to be around nice people like you, because you scared me to death, because I was embarrassed for me. Ego. Ego. But you knew exactly who I was, and you said, "It's going to be all right." And I thought, if I hear that one more time, I'm going to die in spite of you. But Doc Newton went down, and he got his little black bag out, and he came back, and he gave me a sedative of some kind, shot, hypo. And he started me on the paraldehyde, and the members of the North Kansas City group went back and got the orange juice and the honey and the Coke syrup and started feeding it to me, and a lot of it came back up. And that's the way I got sober. Now, folks, that's a treatment center. It's called an AA hall. It's called you. It's called understanding another human being. It's called compassion for somebody that's suffering. That's what we have to give away. That's what God, in His infinite wisdom, omnipotent wisdom, has given us the power to save another life. And it's called understanding. And it's called love for another human being. Because we know what you're going through. And all of a sudden, it's almost morning. And those people stuck around with me 24 hours. Around the clock. And the next day they thought, well, the captain needs a bath. And I agreed with that. So they took the captain's clothes off and discovered captains didn't wear underwear in those days. Easy to explain. Aquavelva and Fruit of the Looms went for about the same price. And Aquavelva always won for some reason. And so you took your clothes down to a washateria around the corner. And about an hour and a half later, you brought them back and you said, well, we've got some good news and some bad news. Now, the good news is that these wool breeches are clean. The zipper's unstuck. What a deal that is. But they kind of shrunk up a little bit there in the crotch, and you kind of have to walk around this way a little bit, you know, to stretch them out. But the shoes are white again. They look like Aladdin's, you know. The toes are curled up a little bit on the ends there. But the shirt just evaporated. We don't know what the hell happened to it, but it's gone. But you can wear that old leather jacket around, and that's the way I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was dishonest. I was a cheat. I was a thief. I didn't want to be there. But there was something that held me, and I'll tell you what it was. And what held me was the attraction. The attraction rather than the promotion. How can these people be so good? How can these people take a dirty bum like me that's lived under a Lady Kenmore box under a bridge and be so good to me? And I didn't have any place else to go, and I was scared to death. Just a little paranoia had set in, because I was scared to death to go down those steps past that police station. And I sure as heck didn't want to go back next door to that bar. So I stayed there, and you made work for me, and you talked to me, and they had the 24-hour squad were people, and I was shaking like a peach orchard borer, just like you were. And the formaldehyde would kick in, and the orange juice and the honey. And you fed me the sauerkraut and the tomatoes. And that's the way I stayed sober that first week. And the members took up a collection and got me a flop down the street. Anybody been to North Kansas City, Missouri? Well, you've been there. You know where the Ben Bolt Hotel is? I hope you don't, but it was a flop about a block and a half down. And North Kansas City is an industrial town, and it's a lot of railroad workers stayed there, and that's where they'd lay over. That's where they'd lay over at the Ben Bolt Hotel. It was one of those little hotels that had probably 25 or 30 rooms, a small bed, a light bulb hanging down from the ceiling, bathroom down the hall. But it was spick and span, just as clean as it could be. And that's where I first got to spend some nights in a clean room, rather than a box, at the Ben Bolt Hotel. And about the second or third week, I was down at the Ben Bolt after the meeting, and I'm probably the only one in the whole room that couldn't sleep, you know, when early in sobriety. Just toss and turn and think, and God, that's bad for newcomers just to think. And I had this book, and by the way, for anybody that's new and you're broke, steal a big book. You can pay us back later on if you don't have the money to buy one. But I stole my first big book, and I had it with me, and I was flopping on that bed, and I opened my big book, and it fell open to page 63, which remains to be my favorite page of this great, great textbook on Alcoholics Anonymous. And I read this. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, as we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter, we were reborn. I read that and I thought, I wonder if it can happen. I continued to read, and it says, we were now at step three. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood Him, and then it went into this third step prayer. God, I offer myself to Thee, to do with me and to fill with me as Thy will. And here comes the most magical words to a drinking drunk or to a sober drunk who's having big problems.
Relieve me of the bondage of self. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And the most wonderful words I think I've ever heard in the world. I'll take you back to what's read at many groups. When we read how it works, there's that line in there that says we are constitutionally incapable of being honest with ourselves. For years, I didn't think that I could make the program because I was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. But here's what that means, newcomers, old-timers, whomever. Here's what that means. You can't look in the mirror. That's all it means. You can't look in the mirror. You're constitutionally incapable of being honest with yourself because you don't like the monster in the mirror that you see. That person in the mirror that looks back is not you, it's a monster. And that's why I drank. To relieve me from the bondage of self. And whiskey did a wonderful, wonderful job of relieving me of the bondage of self for years and years and years. But I had to find something else if I was going to be successful and go to meetings as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in those days, I didn't know what it was except I was hanging on by my fingernails to what those folks said in those meetings, and those old-timers. And I'd sit in those meetings and I'd shake and I couldn't listen. I didn't have any idea what they were saying and I'd sit on my hands. And those were the days when we used to smoke in meetings. So by halftime, when the meeting was half over, you didn't know who was talking because the smoke was down, you know, below chair level. But I used to listen. And then on about 4 or 5 weeks after I'd been sober on Saturday night, I was sitting back on Wino Row. Nothing against the guys sitting on the back row. But back there on Wino Row, where the newcomer sits, you know, so we can take them in-depth inventories of that one in. Look at that one over there. I wonder, yeah, ooh, over there. That looks like an easy touch there. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, very spiritual, you know. Very, very spiritual. And this old geezer was talking up at the front of the room, and he was about 106 years old. Kind of looked like Diz, you know. He's just up there, and he had those Ben Franklin glasses down on the end of his nose, and he was holding up a great big blown-up mugshot of himself when he'd been throwing the slammer out in Hayes, Kansas for a DWI, and he was holding it up here, and he says, "Now there I am drunk, and here I am sober." And again, like this, he'll always look better drunk than he ever would sober. You know, one of those type of guys, you know. And so the meeting was concluding, and the basket was coming around, and I thought it was more blessed to receive than give in those days. I had my hand going back in the basket, and all of a sudden this hand is on mine, and this old geezer says, "Son, I wouldn't do that if I were you, or I'm going to break your arm." And this guy's 103 years old, you know, and I thought, I was caught. Now, the act of stealing is not so bad for an alcoholic, but getting caught, you know, that's the bad part. And he said then those magical words to me, and he says, "By the way, son, I'm your new sponsor." He says, "We drew straws for you, and I lost." A guy by the name of Ken Halstead became my sponsor in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for guys named Ken Halstead. The good old tough sponsor with a heart as big as a marshmallow and as soft. And Ken started guiding me down the steps of the Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had resentments against Ken. He had a Cadillac longer than this room. And Ken smoked those great big fat cigars, and he had it all, I thought. And he was lived in a beautiful home, and I thought, the first time he invited me out to the house, he says, "Now take your shoes off before you come, and I want you to shower because we have new carpet." And when I got out there, he made me take my shoes off because they had new carpet. And his wife, B, was just, she said, "No, you don't sit there, you sit over here."
So I had to sit in the drunk chair, you know, because they had new furniture around, and she was afraid that she was going to catch something from me, I think. But Ken became my banker. Ken became my soulmate. Ken became my mentor. And Kim became my life. And I depended upon Ken. Now, I didn't like a lot of what he had to say, but I loved the way he said it. And I didn't accept everything he said. You know, being, after all, being a captain, an airline captain, you know, having at one time a big house like he had, and two cars, and I love me wall with all my plaques and everything. You know, I'd been somebody, and I hated the fact that. That was all gone, and I resented the fact that I was no longer Mr. Big Shot and all this and that and the other thing. But Ken, God love him, he made it so simple. I was sober about 90 days, and I was cleaning up one Saturday night down in the hall, and one Saturday afternoon down the hall getting ready for the Saturday night meeting, and they'd made work for me that kept me pretty busy. And I'd sit in the chairs up, and I was by myself, and Ken came in. And I took a break, and we were sitting about halfway through in the room here. And the room was about half as big as this room. And we were sitting there, and we were looking towards the front. And Ken was not a real affectionate guy, but he kind of had his arm around me and gave me a little squeeze. And he said, "Son, what step do you think you're on?" Now, I'm 3-4 months sober. And without batting an eye, I said, "Ken, I'm having some trouble with number 9. All of a sudden, I look and the old man's on the floor, and I think, "Jesus, he's having a heart attack." You know, laughing himself to death. You know, tears are coming down his face. And getting up, and he's saying, "Boy, you're on one, and don't you forget." You know, and it's times like these that the new members of Alcoholics Anonymous wish to God they had a car so they could crush their sponsors to death in the AA parking lot. You know, you old fool. Well. That's the way I came into AA. I'll tell you a little bit about me. I'm a Kansas kid. I grew up in a little town in Kansas, a farm community. My grandparents raised me. My granddad was a doctor in this small town, and I worshipped my grandfather. I worshipped my grandfather. And my grandfather was not a real outgoing, affectionate man like many physicians aren't. And I didn't know whether my granddad loved me or not. I knew that I wanted to do anything I could to possibly cause him to give me strokes. Now, my grandmother, she loved me to pieces, and she would hug me. And I'd say to my grandmother, I'd say, "Why doesn't my granddad love me?" And she said, "Oh, honey, your granddad thinks that you're the firstborn grandchild. He loves you to pieces." And then I'd cry and say, "Well, why doesn't he show me?" And she'd get tears in her eyes, and she'd say, "Well, sometimes it's hard for men to show their affections." And I said, "Well, what can I do to please my grandfather? What can I do to make him make him show me that he cares about me and loves me?" And she says, "I'll tell you what you can do. You're not a very good student. You can make some good grades, and that'll please your grandfather more than anything." So for the next, and I was in the third or fourth grade, so for the next 9-week period, I worked my you-know-what off. And I did my studies, and I stayed off the playground, and after school I came in, and I didn't play with John Amos or Gary Franck or Arnold Klum. I went straight to my room, and I studied, and I studied, and I worked, and I worked. And that 9-week period, I brought home 5 A's and 1 B. Now, there's a star in the east when Creighton brings home 5 A's and 1 B, I'll tell you. But I brought them home at dinner time, unlike Tommy, farm communities, lunch is not lunch, it's dinner. And supper is supper, not dinner. And so I brought them home at dinner time, at lunchtime, and my grandmother looked at my great card and she hugged me to her bosom and she says, "Your grandfather's going to be so proud of you." And I just beamed. And I thought I'd finally made it. And my granddad got home and he put on his horn-rimmed glasses or his little Ben Franklin glasses and sat down at his end of the table and tucked his napkin in and looked at that great card and looked at me and guess what he said? "That B needs some improvement." I'd never made a B, let alone A's in my life. And I was crushed. And my grandmother gave him a stern look. But yet, listen to this. Listen to this. All you daddies out there, especially. From the second floor bedroom window of my house that night, I heard my grandfather out on the driveway saying to Emma Hoxley, the widow lady that lived next door, "Emma, Emma, Creighton made 5 A's and 1 B, and I'm so proud of him." And I thought to myself, why couldn't you tell me that? Why couldn't you tell me that? It's that old macho stuff. I've found out in 27 years of sobriety that the word macho has no bearing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It used to be I couldn't cry. Didn't know how to cry. I knew how to drink. And I covered up a lot of tears with crying. And the only time I cried was several times and a couple of times in NAM and a time or two after NAM. But for my own kids, I couldn't show that love. Because we pass it on, you see. Pull up your own socks. You know, do this, do that. And my kids would try to, kids would try their darndest to please me. Well, that looks like a nice dress. It's too short, but it's a nice dress. You know, this and that and the other thing. You can make better grades. You're no dummy. Da, 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 da. My kids used to call me the Great Santini, you know. And I think I fit the description. And now, through you, through the grace of a loving God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you, I can go down and cry for a new grocery store opening, you know, because I'm so glad they're going to be successful, you know. And the joy and the tears in this room of the people who don't have never met each other before, but we're so happy that you're doing well. Or last night when Ken was talking about what he felt like. Because you see, I wasn't a very good student, but I footballed my way through high school and I footballed my way through college. I had a college scholarship to play football. By the way, Ken played football on a college scholarship at Penn State a little after I did. I was at the University of North Carolina. And then I went on to the pros and I played a couple of years of pro ball in Washington, D.C., and I wasn't the greatest player in the world, but back in those days, you know, if you're warm and dumb, they'd sign you to a contract. I made $6,000 a year, you know. Pretty Boy, that was Frank Gifford, was making about $18,000. Johnny U was making about $12,000. They didn't pay us much. We all had to have second jobs in those days. But we had a great time because the city of Washington or any other pro team wouldn't let you buy a drink or a meal. They all took care of us, you know. And those were great years. They were fun years. Those were the fun drinking years. And then that military graft was catching up with me, and I took some tests and was able to pass these tests, and I was headed for flight school. But a funny thing happened to me on the way to flight school. I took drunk again, and I ended up in Paris, South Carolina as a grunt marine, as an enlisted man. And I joined the Marine Paratroopers and went through an Army jump school. That's bad behavior. But I finally got into that flight school, and I finally learned how to fly those airplanes. And I found something that I was good at. And I found something that I could do that I was proud of. And I graduated from that flight school and headed for El Toro, California, with one of the worst hangovers I've ever had. Didn't drink much in flight school. But you see, the disease concept was still going on because all of a sudden I was into me and I'd found something I was good at, and all of a sudden I was king of the world. I was the most arrogant, pompostic so-and-so that there ever was. And my pomposity just bled out all over everything, you know. And I'd sit in that jet out in El Toro and on our training flights, and I'd fly 3 feet off your wing. And I'd tuck that wing in, you know, and get it in the air flowing. And so I'd never touch your wing, but I had a little trick that the air, when you compact the air through, get the pressure real tight, and you can get under another guy's wing a little bit and move your wing up a little bit, it'll lift them up a little bit. And, you know, little tricks like that.
ha, ha, ha. Funny little things like that, you know. And we had a great time, and I was young, and I was bulletproof, and I was invincible. And I'd land that fighter. It was an F-8, flying F-80s. And I'd land that fighter, and I'd raise that canopy and put my arms up on that canopy rail and flick that oxymask to one side and light that Camel cigarette and think, what, you know, I wonder what the poor people in the world are doing today. Because you know? Here is Studley Hungwell, out here. You know, right here. Taxi it in, you know. Hello, world. Here I am. Look at me, Mom. Here I am. And I'd taxi in, and by this time I'd married a wonderful, wonderful lady, and we'd had a child. We had a small baby. And I'd taxi that aircraft in, and I'd park it, and I'd get out and climb down the ladder and take over, go to the equipment shack, and I'd hang my equipment up and take my helmet off and hang it up. And I'd walk out, and I'd have to, you know, I'd be headed for home after a debriefing. And all of a sudden it hit me just like that, and I thought, God, I got to go home. And I almost become petrified. Because 15, 20, 30, 40 minutes before that, I'd been the most responsible person you could ever meet in your life. I was flying at very high air speeds, Mach numbers, very high Mach numbers, speed of sound numbers, 3 or 4 or 5 feet off your wing. And I trusted you implicitly, and you trusted me implicitly. I was the most responsible guy you ever met in your life. And now I've landed, and I've taxied that aircraft in, and I've gotten out, and I got to go home, and I didn't know. I was the most irresponsible person in the world, because I didn't know how to act as a father or a husband. And I didn't know what responsibility was of a child. Didn't know what the responsibility of a home was. Hadn't a clue. So I'd have to go over to that bar. And I'd sit down at that bar, and I'd look in that bar, and after that second Everclear martini would slide down, just so, you know, I'd look in that back mirror. And that back mirror in that bar was made for guys named Creighton. Because I could look in that mirror and I'd drink that and that long black wavy hair had come in there. I never had long black wavy hair when I had hair, you know. And that dimple would come right in here, you know. And I'd raise that arm up, and it was an arm of steel. And I was a lover and a killer. And I had 75 cents worth of hot tamale running right down the front of me here, you know, and couldn't lick my lips. And I'd look down at that bar and see some good-looking gal sitting down there, and I'd say, blah, 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 blah. And they'll move 20, they'll leave or move 20 stools down. Every once in a while, one would go right back to you. And off into a meaningful relationship you go. Very spiritual. That's funny to us, but those future Al-Anons are staying home with that kid, changing the diapers, and the milk bill hasn't paid, so they're pouring the water on the post-toasties for the child. Self-centered, 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 self-centered fear. Self-centered, trying to escape from the person that's inside. Trying to be something I'm not. Spending money I never had. Trying to please people I don't even like. Time after time after time. Well, you'll go nuts if you stay around in a situation like that. So what I did was I ran overseas, and in those days you could run overseas pretty quick. I'd been overseas about 6 weeks, and I was standing before my commanding officer, and my commanding officer called me into his office one day, and he was not a happy camper. We intuitively know these things. And I was standing before him in a stiff brace, and he looked up at me and he says, "You're a bum." And I thought, the word's out. They know. You see, I'd known I'd been a bum for a long time. I knew that when I looked in that mirror, that I saw a bum. Good morning, bum. How are you? You need a drink. And then you can turn into a hot shot fighter pilot. But when you wake up in the morning and you're shaking like a peach orchard boy and you look in the mirror, you see the monster or the bum. And I knew I was a bum. And he says, you haven't sent any money home to your wife. Your wife's on Navy relief. Never knew a Navy officer or a Marine officer whose wife was on Navy relief. If I had the power, I'd kick you out of the service. But we need jerks like you because there's a big war coming. Now get the hell out of my office. Now I'd walk out of that office and what would I say? That bitch, how could she do this to me? Because you see, just like you, I was carrying enough guilt for 20 people. And I didn't need any more guilt. What I needed was a drink to make the monster go away. And all of a sudden I started having bedmates called guilt and remorse. And every morning, those two bedmates of mine would reach in my gut and say, good morning, Creighton, and reach into my gut. And they were called guilt and remorse. And I had to have a drink. I had no longer had a choice. And I was doing the best I knew how to do. As the book says, I was running as fast as I knew how to run. And then all of a sudden, I get a letter that wife has divorced me. And I went, whew, I breathed that sigh of relief. But I could go down to the bar now with the boys and say, well, I got that Dear John. They said, God, man, got to get Dear John. And that commanding officer gave me a week off to stay drunk and stay out of that fighter. And boy, did I wallow in self-pity. Woo. You know, that's paradise for a drinking drunk. In here, I was glad that she had left. Did I love her? Of course I did. Of course I did. Drunks are the most compassionate people in the world. We just don't know how to express it. And all of a sudden, I'm back in the States. And I haven't done anything different. You know. And all of a sudden, I'm married again to another gal. And we have another child. And I run back overseas again because run, drink, run. I was escaping, trying to escape from me. But me goes with me every place me went. And so did the mirror. And so did the mirror. And this time there's a shooting war going on, and that morning came that I knew would come sooner or later. And I was walking out to that fighter, and I was in a blackout. And my crew chief, my plane captain, we called him, says, sir, you don't look very good this morning. I said, I don't feel very good this morning. I was going to fly with the dearest friend I ever had in my life. Greatest guy I ever knew in my life. Golden hands. Means he's a good pilot. Fantastic pilot. He had three kids. He was a good family man. He was on his way. He would have made stars. He would have become a general. And he was going to be my wingman that morning. And we crawled into those fighters and we were headed north, and I came out of that blackout and I thought, am I going out on a mission or am I coming back from one? And that's a bad place to be. And another 20 minutes we're going at a very high rate of airspeed at a very low altitude of which we were both supposed to be. And the problem was that I was lost. I flew up the wrong valley. And we picked up some fantastic ground fire. And I turned into my wingman and I killed him in the blink of an eye. And then I played those games. Why me, God? Why did Terry die? Why wasn't it me? Because you see, the wise man was right. The eyes are the windows to our soul. And my soul was as black as night. And I hated me worse than I'd ever hated me before. And I couldn't drink enough to put the fires out. And I laid in that hospital. And I laid there. And I hated me so bad I couldn't shave. You know, since I've been in AA, I've talked to a lot of people, both gals and guys. You've been there too. The Al-Anons too. The Al-Anons hate themselves so bad because they can't do anything about it either. And they have big tears. But we learn tricks. And only alcoholics and only Al-Anons know these tricks. How to put lipstick and mascara on without looking in the mirror. Without looking at yourself. How to shave without looking in the mirror. Because we see the monster.
and we can't live with ourselves. And the Al-Anon survived. God love us, I don't know how. But the alcoholics, we have to drink. We have no choice. Otherwise, we would go totally, totally, totally insane. We're already crazy. But it puts the fire out. Even temporary relief is better than no relief at all. And I got out of those hospitals and I told that wife, I said, honey, I'm going to turn over new leaf number 742. And I meant it. Because if I'd taken a lie detector just like you at the time, I would have passed it. Because I believed that. I believed that I was going to change. I believed that I was not going to take another drink at the time. Because I so desperately didn't want to. I wanted to change my behavior. I just didn't have a program to do it with. I didn't have a big book. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have somebody I could go to. I didn't have a mark that I could call on the telephone and whimper to. You see. Because I had to have that machoism, that big manism. Go down to those bars and fly those airplanes up and down the bar and cash another hot check and be somebody. When I was making a ton of money with that airline that I'd gone with when I got out of the service, it was always broke. It was always broke. Was behind on my alimony and child support. And finally that day came when that wife, that second wife, said, I've had it. And I said, honey, it's going to be different this time. I promise it's going to be different. And they want to believe us and we want to believe ourselves. But by this time I was sitting naked in trees. My yard. My tree. And I'd fall out of the tree revealing my shortcomings, you know, to everybody in the neighborhood. And she committed me. As she should have. And I was in the real spin dry unit. The one that doesn't have doorknobs on your side and padded walls. And my chief potter came up and he was my drinking buddy. I was not dumb. I was crazy, but I wasn't dumb. I always picked somebody in authority to drink with and be friends with so that they could get me out of jams. And he came up there and he says, we got to get you out of town. He says, you know, if the newspapers get a hold of this airline pilot in the insane asylum, it might be, you know, deter ticket sales a little bit. So the company, God love them, played enabler and got me out of there. And this wife had left and I breathed another sigh of relief. Not because I didn't love her, not because I didn't love that child, but I didn't want to take them any further down into the depths of degradation and deprivation that I'd already done. And I started flying all over the world. How is Hong Kong? Great. Great. They'll build you a suit while you're sitting at the bar, you know. How's Paris? Great bar. How's Johannesburg? Super bar. How's Lima, Peru? Bad jail. Great bar, you know. All over the world. It's easy to explain. Golfers golf, fishermen fish, and drunks drink. And then that day came. That day came. That day came. And Lyle P., whose story is in the big book, and Creighton P. are the two guys, the only two guys that I know of that were commercial airline pilots that got DWIs in airplanes and got felonious charges, felony charges pressed against us. And what happened to me is I never had a DWI in a car in my life. I did in 727. And that's bad for career development. And it'll get you in a lot of trouble. And I wasn't drunk. I was like Lyle. I was terribly hungover. And I slid that 727 off an icy runway that I would have done sober. And the FAA admitted that later on. But I slid that thing off and the feds were there and the company fired me and I was up for charges and I'm not going to take a fist step with you, but a lot of things happened that I lost my license. And I lost my medical certificate. And I came this close to going to the federal slammer forever and ever. but they gave me a choice, and I got out of Dodge. And that was in January of 1974, and then a lot of things happened to me that have really none of your business for the next 2 years, but I shared some of those in the car last night, and that's all I need to say about that. And the Lady Kenmore box. And then you. And then sobriety. A little at a time. A little at a time. A little at a time. 3 years of sobriety, and I've been in Kansas City. And my sponsor caused me to have a job. All sponsors should have their pigeons work. I don't care what it is. I'm a perfect example. I was an airline captain. Responsible for a lot of lives, flying all over the world, making an awful lot of money, making a pocket bucket full of money. But my first job in AA was it wasn't a position. I became a China technician, dishwasher. But I had to have a job. And my sponsor needed to take some of that arrogance and pomposity out of me. And I no longer had to, you know, put on that uniform, take my wings off my pajamas and put them on my uniform before I went to the work and look in the mirror and say, "You good-looking son of a gun, don't you ever die," you know. But I'd get to go to the Hobart dishwasher machine and wash dishes at 5 o'clock in the morning at the Gold Buffet restaurant. And my sponsor would come in for coffee about 8 o'clock with some of the other old-timers, old geezers, I call them, you know. "How's your boy back there in the kitchen?" Ha, 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 ha. And I'd go to those noon meetings. They started noon meetings. And I'd go to the evening meetings. And my whole life became AA. I didn't have any place else to go. And I was scared to death to go to any place else. Because I was hanging out with people who all of a sudden understood me. And as hard-hearted as some of those old hard-hearted sponsors were, every once in a while they'd start in giving me a hug. And I thought, geez, these men hug each other, you know. And they're not lighting the loafers either. I mean, they really are. They hug each other. And then all of a sudden I found out one night that Ken said, after a meeting, and he'd take me back to my little house that I'd gotten. And by this time I'd worked my way up to a food broker, or working for a food broker. And he took me back to my little house in North Kansas City, Missouri, and we'd sat in the car for a few minutes and talked, and I went inside. And he reached over and he patted my leg, and he says, "I love you, son." And I went inside and I cried, and I cried myself to sleep. Not out of anguish, but out of joy, that another man had said something to me, that he genuinely appreciated me, that all of a sudden, I'm changing. And then we started doing fifth step work, and I talked about this in our workshop last Friday. And if you want to hear that story, buy the tape. I'm trying to help you out all I can, Brad. But the fifth step, and ninth step work were terribly, terribly important for me. And the tenth step work. And in 1976, there was a lady that my sponsor said, "I want you to call. And I want you to invite her up here for Christmas." I said, "I can't do that." And the lady's name was Jeanette Pendarvis, and she is my mom. And I hadn't talked to my mother in years and years and years. Because, you see, the last time I'd talked to my mother had been on her front porch in Tulsa, Oklahoma. When I'd gone and I'd put that key in the door to unlock the door to go in because I needed some more money. I was still flying. I was an international pilot, DC-8 captain. And this was about 1973, and I was making about $145,000 a year, which was a lot of money today. It was a hell of a lot of money in 1973. I never had any. And I put that key in the door, and it didn't work. And I knocked on the door, and my mother came to the door, and I said, "Mom, my key doesn't work." And she says, "I know, I changed the locks." And I looked at my mother, and she says, "I know why you're here." I said, "Well, why am I here?" And she says, "Because you need some money." And I said, "Well, I do, Mom, but I wanted to come see you anyway." And she says, "Creighton, I love you more than life itself, but I got to tell you something that's going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. I'm going to have to say no." And I stood on that front porch and I swore at my mother and called her every name I could think of. And I'd like to tell you that I was drunk. I was as sober as I am right this minute. Just real, real sick. And I screamed at her and left. And that had been the last time I'd spoken to my mother. And Christmas of 1976, I had been sober 9 months. And I was scared to death to make that phone call. Now you know why. It's called embarrassment. It's called ego. But my sponsor says, go ahead and call her. Invite her up for Christmas. And so I called her and I said, Mom, I can't afford an airline ticket, but I'll send you a bus fare. Now, my mother could afford the airline ticket, but she says, I would love for you to do that, because she was making me responsible for my own actions. So I sent her the money for a long, long bus ride. And I called Ken and I said, she's coming. She's, my mom's coming up for Christmas. He says, I knew she would. I called her a month ago. So we had Christmas dinner with my sponsor and his wife and had one of the greatest Christmases there ever was. And we spent all Christmas Day and the next day after Christmas, Boxing Day, they call it in Canada, crying and hugging. And for the first time in my life, and I was 40 years old, I heard my mother say, I love you. And you see, I thought my mother had deserted me. Nah, she hadn't deserted me. She had just had to get out of Dodge because she'd been married to a bad drunk in a small town. And she let my grandparents raise me because she knew that was probably best. But for the first time in my life, I heard my mother. Am I saying that she had never said that before? Of course not. But I was starting to hear. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous allows us to start to hear. And I heard her tell me that she loved me. And I said, I love you, Mom. And those relationships was restored. About a year after that, my sponsor says, I want you to go to Oklahoma City. I want you to talk to those FAA and AA folks down there. And I said, Ken, you know, you don't understand. I'm this far from being a felon. I'm on probation. You know, my PO... I got, you know him as well as I do. We go to see him, you know, once a month. He says, well, I think I still want you to go down there and talk to those folks at the FAA. And I said, you don't understand, Ken. You understand a lot of things, but you just don't understand this. And I was angry about this. So on my way to Oklahoma City, I was wondering what I was going to tell these people. And I was going down to the medical examiner's office, the Federal Aviation Medical Examiner's Office, for all the FAA. See ya. What? Five? Am I running over? I got 5 minutes to go? I got to wrap it up. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting in front of this doctor's office, and this secretary says, you must be Creighton Pendarvis. Now, I'm just a little paranoid. And I thought, how does she know who I am? They're going to get me. And all of a sudden this doctor says, come on in here, boy. And I went in and I sat down and he says, what can I do for you, son? And before I left, I said, Ken, what am I going to tell these people? And he says, you're going to tell them the truth for once in your life. Tell them the truth. So I started telling my spiel to this guy, and all of a sudden he pulls something out of his pocket and he tosses it up on the desk, and I pick it up and it says, to thine own self be true. And there was an X and a 5 and 2 1s. And I look up and I says, you know Ken Halstead? And he says, he is my first sponsor. And Dr. Audie Davis was 17 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Gave me my license to fly airplanes back that afternoon. Well, it just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. And I became an airline pilot again. I didn't mean to run over. I appreciate y'all folks staying with me. Let me finish up this way. I have two daughters. Paige was my oldest daughter, and I deserted her when she was 2 years old. And in my fifth step, I called Paige. I wrote Paige, and she wrote me a letter back. And I hadn't seen her in 17 years. And I didn't expect to hear from her, because in my ninth step work, I was trying to sweep off my side of the street. And I wanted to hear from her, but my sponsor kept saying, you may never hear from her, but that doesn't make any difference. Because the ninth step tells us what? That you're sweeping off your side of the street. That you can walk a free man or a woman at last. And then I got that note in the mail, and it says, Dear Daddy, I love you. And from a daughter I hadn't seen in 17 years, she wanted to see me. And she came back, and we got together. And I'd like to tell you that it was like nothing had changed, and that's not true. But we had a relationship, and we had a dialogue between the two of us. And she forgave a lot of stuff. And today, Paige is a very successful young lady in outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And she's doing great. And my other little fireball, my other little daughter, who hated me worse than she hated guts. And she would write me birthday cards or Christmas cards and say, Happy birthday, you GDSOB. Happy Father's Day, you GDSOB. Call me on the telephone. How are you, GDSOB? Click and hang up. You know, that love-hate relationship. And then her mother called me in 1984, and said, Tracy's got anorexia. And I thought, how can a kid of mine have anorexia, you know? And I didn't realize that it was a disease very similar to alcoholism. And she was going to starve herself to death. She was going to get strokes, negative or positive, didn't make any difference, some way. And her mother asked me to come be with her in a treatment facility up there for a week, family week. And I went up and I came back and I was so angry. I was angry at me. I wasn't angry at her, because she had really lowered the boom on me. Deservedly so. And I came back and I went to David. By this time I'd lived in Dallas, Texas, because I'd gotten my job back flying for the airlines. And David Aronofsky was my sponsor. And I was talking to David and I was whimpering to him and sniveling to him about, well, you know, why did And he says, go talk to Gracie, for God's sakes. And Gracie Aronofsky, who is black belt Al-Anon. And I was talking to Gracie, and there's a lady by the name of Elsa Chamberlain who was in town that weekend. And Elsa and Gracie took me to my first AA Al-Anon meeting that night. And I became an Al-Anon. Now let me share with you what happened that night. I walked into that Al-Anon meeting and we were introducing ourselves, and I said, I'm Creighton Pendarvis, an alcoholic. Whoop! And all of a sudden I'm bleeding from the shin, where Elsa Chamberlain, true story, kicked the you-know-what out of my shin and said, with those sparkling blue eyes and those little thin blue lips and that wonderful operatic voice, she says, Creighton, we don't introduce ourselves except as Al-Anons or guests, because you see, if you introduce yourself as an alcoholic, there are women in this room and men in this room who will hate your guts and knife you as you leave. Now, learn another lesson. And I go to two Al-Anon meetings a week and two or three AA meetings a week now. I love Al-Anon because, you see, Al-Anon gave me the route from my head to my heart. And I learned how to deal with that anger. I learned how to deal with that anger from the inside. And I could look in the mirror and the monster had started going away. And then in 1992, that same daughter that used to write me those horrible birthday cards announced that she was going to marry an Air Force pilot. Air Force. And with all due respect, Colonel. And she wanted me to be there. And she wanted me to walk her down the aisle. And I walked my daughter down the aisle in San Diego, California, of one of those beautiful missions, the old mission church. I walked her down the aisle, and then we went to the reception out at the amphibian base. And usually it's obviously it's custom for the bride and groom to have the first dance. And she came to me and she says, I've asked Chris, that's her husband. I've asked Chris for permission, and would you have the first dance with me, Dad? And I said, of course, I would love to. And so Tracy and I had the first dance, and guess what the music was? You're the Wind Beneath My Wings. And it doesn't get any better than that. It just doesn't get any better than that. Direct gifts from God. Direct gifts from God. Dear God, thanks to you for my life, that I live in a home and not in a box under a bridge or in a cell in an institution. And thanks be to you, God, for carrying me to A's doorstep and leaving me there. And thanks, God, for my children and my grandchildren who love me and who respect me. And thanks again, God, for allowing me to retire from a wonderful business of which I dearly love, and that of flying. And God, thanks so much for my May Queen, who's now my wife and my closest ally. But most of all, God, thanks be to you for never having forgotten my name. Thanks, and God bless, Flint River.